there, everybody. You are listening to This Show Is So Gay. I'm your host, Ken Schneck. This is episode number 376. As always, you can get in touch with us by dropping us a line, send an email on over to ken@thisshowissogay.com, stroll on over to thisshowissogay.com to learn all about the fun things happening with our little gay radio show that could. You can follow us on Twitter, the handle is thisshowissogay, and of course, go on over to that Facebook, type in thisshowissogay, like us, because we sure as heck like you. What a fun show we have for you this week. We must get started with our guest. Elijah Oberman is one of the co-founders of The Shondas, a rock band from Brooklyn, New York. Their music has had us singing along and entranced for so many years. They have toured all over the country and headline U.S. and European tours, including shows with Her, Electrolane, our beloved Amy Ray of the Indigo Girls, Lesbians on Ecstasy, who I don't know who they are, but that sounds like a fun name, and many, many more groups. Additionally, the Shondas have performed at festivals, including the CMJ Music Festival in New York, South by Southwest in Austin, and North by Northeast in Toronto, and they have a new album. It's called Brighton. It's brilliant. I've been listening to it nonstop. We're going to talk all about it, but first, Elijah, welcome back to This Show Is So Gay.
Thank you so much for having me again, and congratulations on 376.
It's been 3 years since you've been on the show. It's been a lot of episodes since then.
It's amazing. It's congratulations.
Well, thank you. Well, thank you. We have so much ground to cover, my friend. Are you ready?
No, I am so ready.
Well, can we just let's get the negative part out of the way first. I will tell you, we're going to cleanse the air. Let's get rid of the negative part, because I always do have to remind you, my mother very much does not like the name of your band.
I know. I send my deepest apologies to your mother. It was probably a terrible choice. You know, she obviously knows best, as I'm sure you're well aware.
I'm well aware.
Yeah, no, I know that the name does mean, you know, a shame or a disgrace in Yiddish, for those of you who didn't know. And yes, many of our Jewish mothers and grandmothers think that it's very funny, and others think that it is actually simply a shaka.
But then I played a song for her and she was on board, so we're okay. We just got to get past the word for her.
Okay, good.
Okay.
I'm glad we slightly redeemed ourselves.
Yes, slightly. But that's it. We've cleansed the air. We've burned the sage. Are you aware that it's been, I would assume that you are aware, it's been 10 years since you started the Shondas.
Oh my God, I know. I mean, in some ways, we may as well be a different band, right? You know, like, I think a lot of other people would have just gone with a new name. I am sure your mom would agree. But yeah, but I think, you know, the reason why we are still the Shondas 10 years later is because it's, you know, based on Louisa and I's collaboration and her voice and her, you know, and my violin and, you know, her songwriting style and our songwriting style together. And so in some ways, even though we've changed so much, you can definitely still hear, you know, what we were doing 10 years ago and what we're doing now, I think.
What do you remember about what you and Louisa set out to do, right? You were in another band, am I correct? And then you decided to form this one.
The band that we were in before was her high school band that I joined when we met when I was in college. And, you know, I think a lot of people play in bands when they're in high school and college and then go on to make wiser career choices. But Louisa and I really wanted to do it professionally and really wanted to be serious about it. And so that's when we started the Shondas. And, you know, I think the thing that really brings us together is the desire to write music that is really emotional and emotionally evocative. And I think her, you know, her lyrics and her voice are really emotional. And I think that the way that I play violin is, and, you know, and I at least think we're somewhat successful in that, because that's what a lot of people tell us, is that that our music isn't just something that you put on in the background, but that it, you know, that it makes you feel something and that it helps them deal with their feelings or access their feelings. And I think that's a lot of why we do it, for ourselves and for our fans.
Seen so many bands come and go, certainly in a decade amount of time, you know, bands come and go. How would you say that your relationship with Louisa has changed over the past 10 years?
You know, it's funny. We are in some ways like opposites as people. And it's funny, like I, you know, sometimes even in our reviews, people will pick up on it. You know, people will be like, Louisa has like, is such a force of nature that all of her energy is just like exploding out. And Eli is all turned in and he's like crumpling on himself on the floor. We're, you know, so we're so, so different. And I think it's definitely an opposites attract situation. And I think that, you know, as both as musical collaborators and as friends, I think the fact that we have such a strong musical bond has meant that our friendship has grown, you know, over 10 years in a way that I might not have, you know, music has kept us together through thick and thin. And so, you know, in hard times, you know, where other people may have drifted apart, we've stayed together because of our shared passion and love for doing this thing together. And so I think it's actually been an incredibly important part of my life as a person to like grow through our friendship together.
Amazing. Amazing. We should say, and we will play a couple songs off the new album. For people who don't know the Shondas, how would you describe the sound?
In the like most basic terms, I would say that we're a rock band with female lead vocals and violin and drums and bass and guitar, and you can sing along and dance along. But yeah, we're a rock band.
I love it. In my head, and you tell me if this is true, often things in my head, not exactly true, but in my head, you are a different person when you pick up the violin. Like right now, you're not holding your violin, but my assumption would be if you picked it up, you would feel like a different person. Is that true?
That is so true. That is really true. I am like totally an introvert, and then when we get on stage, I just kind of lose it.
I would imagine that you have watched some playback of you on stage, some video, and you've said, I don't think that's me.
I know, yeah, no, it's shocking. It took me a while to get there. Like, first I was just, like, I had horrible stage fright, and I would just stand like a deer in headlights, and then, you know, you like eventually learn that how ridiculous you feel when you're doing a thing that it doesn't actually look like that.
Well, because I know that you're an introvert and because I'm feeling reasonably confident that you're pretty uncomfortable with praise, I'd like to introduce a new segment to our show called Praise for Elijah, because I just think it's going to be fun for you. I know. These are quotes that have been said about you. Some of them I'm not exactly sure what they mean, so I need you I need you to help me explain.
Okay.
You might want to pick up your violin for this. It might help. I don't know. All right. Quote number one. You know all these quotes, too. Quote number one from Rolling Stone. They said that you, I don't even know what this means, but it's pretty evocative. Quote, scrapes hornets and angels from his fiddle.
I can't claim to totally know what it means, but I'm pretty sure it's flattering. You know, I think, I think hopefully in my hopeful imagination, it's about bringing together sort of the like grittiness of playing, you know, violin in a punk band with the beauty that the violin is more often known for, and that somewhere in that tension is where I do my work.
Okay. All right. Number two in our new segment that we'll be doing weekly called Praise.
There
really are only 14, so we're good. You're almost there. You are almost there. I'm only going to do one more because I do love this one. I think that it will yield a couple questions. So Hebrew School, that publication, said, Elijah has that rare mastery of post-punk violin playing that only seems to come along once in a generation, reminiscent of early Raincoats. So what I want you to do for our listening audience, tell us one thing that you feel like you do really well with the violin, and then I might have a follow-up question.
Well, I don't know how well I do it, but it is what I try to do is, you know, the violin is really a voice. And when you're in a rock and pop context where there is a lead singer that's an actual voice, I think figuring out where to place violin so that it supports that voice as opposed to being a distraction from it is something that is difficult and that I am always trying to do and trying to do better.
Yeah. That word mastery jumps out at me. Are there things that, you would like to work on? I'm not saying this is like a job interview. What would you like to improve, right? I hope you get the job, as in everyone needs to order the new album. But what are you working on with your own skill that, you would like to put out there to the world?
You know, I was trained classically when I was little for many years, and then I quit for a long time, and then I you know, started playing punk with Louisa, and I don't regret any of it for a second, but my classical technique is not what it once was. And that's okay, because I'm not a classical violinist, but I would like to get some of it back. I think I would feel better if my technique was a little sharper.
Okay. That ends this week's edition of Praise for Elijah. We will be doing it every week with or without you. With or without you. You know,
just throw it in the casual conversation.
Oh, yeah. No, I just do it. I'm in the middle of class and I say, guys, this is what we're going to do. This is what we're going to do. You know, I had the unbelievable honor of and pleasure yesterday. I hosted a quality brunch at my house and about 40 people came over and Eli Conley Skyped in and played a couple songs for us. We love Eli. We love Eli.
Yes.
And everybody should go support Eli's Kickstarter, raising money there. And one of my favorite topics to talk about, because we talk week in and week out for 8 years now about how important voice is. And one of the fun parts in talking to you and talking to Eli is that there's an evolution of voice both artistically and physically. How do you navigate that as you put your voice out there to the world?
Yeah, I mean, one thing that, you know, just in case your listeners don't know, that I'm a trans person. So I think gender had always had a lot to do with how I felt about my voice and the way that I sang. And I think that, you know, it's not like I was ever a soprano or something. Mm-hmm. I think I always tried to sing as low as I could in an effort to feel more aligned with my own, like, sense of my own gender, or to project that outwards. And so one thing that I've learned is that my, like, really the most powerful places in my range are not high, but higher than I thought. Mm-hmm. And so I think embracing that and singing up in my register has really helped me find the power that my voice can have.
I love it. I love it. Well, I don't know if you heard, you have a new album out called Brighton.
I heard.
It's good. I get nervous. One day I'm going to do one of these interviews and I'm going to surprise someone. And they're going to say, I had no idea. That sounds like something I should go get. You have this new album called Brighton. Is there a narrative thread that you would say connects all the tracks?
I don't know about a narrative thread. I definitely think a lyrical thread.
Yeah.
You know, I think in some ways, you know, lots of musicians and lots of writers, you know, that I hear say, like, oh, you know, every song I write is really the same song, or like every poem that I write is really the same poem. And I definitely identify with that. And in some ways, the song that the Shondas keep writing over and over and over is about how to be the most fully alive that you can be. And sometimes that is, you know, feeling hopeful and feeling joyful, and sometimes it's feeling despair, but it's always like with this sense of very present aliveness. And I think one of the, you know, the lyrical threads that ties Brighton together is that Louisa, you know, during, like, right before and during writing this record, you know, fell in love and got married to her partner, who is also my brother. And so I think writing these songs from this sense of peace and what it feels like to feel peace and happiness, and the way that it makes you aware of what it felt like not to have those things for so long, is something. So that, you know, there are a lot of love songs on this record, but not just in a you know, saccharine way, if that makes sense.
Oh, it does. It does. Again, listeners, we are here with Elijah Oberman, one of the co-founders of the Shondas, new album out called Brighton. Everyone should download it right this second. Let's talk about a couple tracks. I haven't done this segment in so long. This is the part of the show, Elijah, where you get to tell our listening audience. We'll do a little self-analysis, what you think some of these tracks say about Elijah. But if you want to say, you know, how they're about Louisa, that's fine too. But I picked some of my favorite tracks. So let's do a little self-analysis for our listening audience. We, of course, have to start with the big track, Everything Good. What does Everything Good say about Elijah?
Well, I do think, you know, this track is the opening track on the record. And it begins with, you know, sort of these big, robust chords on the guitar and a very sort of triumphant violin line over them. And so I definitely think that that says something about, you know, sort of what we were talking about before, about how I try to use violin in the context of a rock band, which is fairly unusual, and sort of how to use that voice and integrate it into a more traditional pop and rock.
Nice. All right, two more. I'm gonna save the best for last, because one of the tracks messed me up a little bit, but we'll do that last. The next one, what does Holding Out, which I enjoy immensely, what does the track Holding Out say about Elijah?
Well, that one says a lot about me, because I wrote it and I sing it. The song is sort of the idea of waiting or of holding out for something, in this case, holding out for something better. It says a lot about me, because it feels very simultaneously hopeful and despairing, you know, to think that there is something better out there worth holding out for is essentially very hopeful. But usually if you're feeling that way, things aren't that great. And so I think, well, anyone who knows me would say that that says a lot about me.
That's great. Okay, deep breaths. One of the tracks.
Okay, I want to know the ones you're confused about.
I know.
The one you're confused about.
I'm not confused about it. It ripped me to shreds. In fact, I'm pretty clear on the fact that one of the tracks on Brighton ripped me to shreds. And I want to know if you're okay with that. That's part A of the question. But
definitely
great. It's great having you on. All right, tell our listening audience what the track My Ghost says about Elijah.
Oh. You know, it's funny that, you know, Louisa wrote that song, but it actually has a lot in common with Holding Out thematically. That song is about, you know, longing for someone and, you know, a very specific someone who you know is out there, and sort of coming to terms with that for yourself and what it means to be waiting for that person and holding the space for that person inside of you. And so it also very, you know, the album is called Brighton, which is named for Brighton Beach in Brooklyn, which is where Louisa and I both live, which, if people don't know, it's right next to Coney Island. So it's right at the beach. And, you know, so all of these songs were written very soon after Louisa and I both moved down here. And so she, that song also really, like, places the record. She talks about, you know, being on the beach in the snow in the winter, and sort of just, like, you know, kicking the snow and the sand around, and which is, like, you know, not a way that people usually think of the beach, and it's so unusual, and sort of with the, like, frustration and sadness of holding that space for this person.
Yeah. Is it okay if maybe we don't mention to my partner that apparently the track that affected me most was one about waiting and holding out for someone who's not there?
I won't tell.
Okay. I will make sure he does not listen to this episode. How do we go about promoting Brighton? Are we going to be out there in the world?
We are going to be out there in the world. We just released a video for Everything Good on Bitch the other day, last week. And we just got back from a tour, about a month-long tour promoting it. We're taking a little bit of a hiatus while Louisa has a baby.
Oh, look at that.
So that's very exciting. But we hope to be on the road again in March.
Okay. All right. Well, one of the other ways that your name is out there, there is an incredible piece. I mean, truly an incredible piece. And I love when my feed is just blanketed with one article, because there was a little bit of time where, I don't know if you know this, you were kind of social media inescapable. It was on everywhere on my page. So there's
well, I didn't know if it was just my feed.
No. It was mine too. All the gays, wow, all okay. The Jews, and then all the gay Jews were sharing this piece. So we're talking about, listeners, piece in the New York Times called Living as a Man, Fighting Breast Cancer, How Trans People Face Care Gaps. First, can we just step back and say, this was incredible. You have to know that there's quite a bit of bravery in you putting yourself out there this way, correct?
You know, I'm honestly not trying to be humble or modest, but that was one of the things that I kept seeing people say when they would repost that I was the most surprised by and unprepared for. And it didn't feel like that to me. I mean, it's very easy for me to talk about it. It's very easy for me to talk about my experience with cancer. It's very easy for me to talk about my experience with gender. I try to do so because there are so many people who don't feel comfortable talking about it, and I would like for someone to be able to ask me things rather than those people. So that part really was easy. I mean, the thing that I, and therefore not particularly brave to me, the part that I was worried about was that even though we're in a moment where trans issues are getting a lot of coverage, a lot of it is very tokenizing, a lot of it is very surfacey, and, you know, ignores, you know, people who are often in the most need, you know, people like queer youth, people of color, people who are living in poverty, people who can't access healthcare the way I accessed it, even though I had a lot of problems, and people who don't fit into the gender binary at all, genderqueer people. And so the pressure to get something right, like I was just so afraid that they were going to misquote me or that something was going to be horribly wrong and that all of these queer people and trans people would read this and feel that they were supposed to feel that I got it wrong or that I didn't do justice by them and feel that that would have a negative impact on their lives. And so that was actually the thing that I was the most worried about.
Yeah. Again, because I know that you're just so comfortable with praise. I think, again, in 500 guests, you're probably just the most comfortable with praise. You're not at all. But you understand that a piece like this and putting your – I don't care if you understand it. I'm telling you. A piece like this and putting your voice out there in this way and talking about your journey with healthcare, your medical journey – a piece like this is life-saving. People read something like this and say, you know what? I am going to go get checked out. Or you know what? An ally is going to go to their healthcare professional and say, how up are you on having conversations with trans clients? You know, and you need to do better. And so the pieces like this are life-saving, Elijah.
I really hope so. And that's why I did it, you know, obviously because I hoped to do some good there. And I think especially, and just to say that trans health is a thing that exists, that is important, that, you know, people need to prioritize learning about, especially that, you know, providers need to make sure that they are educating themselves on so that they can provide like meaningful information to trans people about their bodies so that they can make informed choices about their health like everyone else, you know? I mean, so that's really important. And, you know, it's funny, there's really just nothing like the New York Times in terms of like prestige and legitimacy and all this stuff. But the thing that made me the most happy of anything, of any response that I heard to the article, was that it had been shared in the newsletter of the Greater New York Hospital Association, because those are the people who are in a position to, you know, make immediate and like concrete differences in the care that trans people receive. And so the fact that medical professionals were reading it and taking it seriously and realizing that they need to do better was actually the best thing for me to hear that came out of it.
Life-saving. And by the way, the most belated question in this entire interview, it should have been first, I should ask, how is your health?
Oh, I am doing fine. I'm doing great. Yeah, I am totally cancer-free and happy and strong and taking care of myself.
How did this interaction with cancer, I think that's probably the understatement of ever to say interaction with cancer, but how did it change the music that you put out there, if at all?
It actually did a lot. You know, I think the band, I got cancer between the band's second and third albums. And our first two records are pretty dark and really about pain in a lot of ways. The first one is, you know, sort of about pain with family of origin, and the second one is a breakup album. And after the second record, when I got sick, you know, things were just so bleak all the time, and for me, but also for Louisa and Tamim, who was in the band at the time, and we were all very close. And we really we didn't want to make that music anymore. Like, we were already really just in that place. And I think that is when our music took a turn, like, much, like, really much more towards pop than we ever had. I think we wrote maybe our first song ever in major. You know, we were like, we want to write songs where that make you happy, that make us feel good, where you can hear the song one time and sing along to the chorus, you know, like, where you want to drive, you know, drive down the highway with the windows down and sing along. And because we needed that, and I needed that. So, yeah, and once we went pop, we never went back.
It
was too much fun.
I love it. I love it. All right. Someone is going to, I mean, many, many people, let's say thousands and thousands of people are going to listen to this interview, and they're going to go straight to where Fine Music is sold. They are going to download Brighton. They will listen to all the tracks at once. Set the mood for us. Set the mood for us. Where would you like someone to listen to it? Let's start there. So set the scene. If someone's thinking, what is the ideal environment for me to set up to listen to this album, set it up for them.
Okay, well, here's a quick, really, really dorky, unsexy thing to say.
I love it.
We care about tech, people. Please don't listen on your laptop speakers. I know you're going to anyway, but, like, file quality matters. Speakers matter. Like, we spent a lot of time making sure that you could hear the bass drum so that you can, like, feel it in your gut and dance. To songs. So, like, just do yourself a favor, and if nothing else, like, do it because you feel bad because I had cancer.
Are you allowed to do that? Of course you are. But that was amazing.
I totally am.
Amazing.
Awesome.
Amazing.
Yeah, just, like, listen on something where you can actually hear. Okay, but setting the scene. Okay, it's either dawn or dusk. It's like in a moment where, like, the light is transitioning and you're moving from something to something else. And maybe you're feeling very quiet and pensive, and you need something to bring you out and boost your energy a little bit. Or maybe you're just in such a good mood and you need something to dance to, and you're going to put it on and you're going to turn it up really loud, and you are going to close your eyes and just let yourself go on a journey.
There it is. And when they finish the last track, should you sneak over to their place at dawn or dusk, wherever they're listening, through unbelievable headphones and not just through the speakers on their laptop, and you have just one sentence for them after they're done listening to the entire album, what would you say?
You got this.
Nice. Nice. By the way, we should say, I would imagine that it's quite important, the order of the tracks. I'm always having my iTunes always set to random, but you probably sat down at some point and said, this is the order we want to put the tracks in, and that's important, right?
Yeah, that is, besides, and let me just say, I know, I don't mean you need to go out and buy, like, $300 speakers. Like, I know, I listen on my earbuds, too, like, it's okay. Like, I'm not trying to be a snob about it. These are the things that keep musicians up at night. And so are things like track order and how we know that no one listens to it like that anymore, but we can't help caring about it anyway. Because, yeah, it is really important. And, you know, part of it is about music conventions, like you want to put the songs that you think might be a single for second or third. So there are things like that, but there are also like, we're really trying to create a narrative arc, and, you know, here it really goes up and here we have a like little break where it comes down, and then there's going to be a really fierce song. And then, you know, we're going to rock out for a couple more and then we're going to get quiet at the end. Or like, do we want to get quiet at the end, or do we want to end on like an up note? You know, and these are definitely things that we talk about for hours and hours and days and days.
Yeah. And here we think we can make a gay Jew radio host in Cleveland cry with my ghost. That's great. I love that I was in a meeting. All right, listeners, this is what
that
you
get. That is one of my favorite tracks on the record.
Oh, so good. So good. Listeners, this is what you guys need to go and do. First, go on over to shondes.com, S-H-O-N-D-E-S.com. You can learn all about the band. You can tour all of their music. There's videos on there. There's photos. You can see Elijah just flailing about on the stage in the most beautiful way. I love it. And of course, this is what I'm urging you to go do. Go to anywhere fine music is sold. If you go to iTunes, wherever it is that you go, and go pick up Brighton. It is, I will tell you this, Elijah, and please convey this to Louisa as well. It's transportive. And that's what I look for when I listen to music. I don't want something. It's funny that you gave a shout out to background music. I don't need background music. I'm good with background music. You know, we all have our background noise. I look for music to take me and put me someplace else. And honestly, Brighton actually makes me feel like I physically went somewhere else. And I'm so appreciative that you can just yank me out of my daily day and take me to a place where I can be more introspective. And as you so wisely said, hey, you got this. And I'm so appreciative of that.
That is extremely, extremely, and thank you so much.
Elijah, please keep using your voice the way that you are using your voice. All our best to all of the Shondas out there, and keep doing what you're doing.
Thank you. You too. Thank you so, so much for having me on, even though you made me listen to Praise About Myself.
It's a weekly segment. Tune in next week. Praise for Elijah. I'm going to now just have guests with Elijah. Thank you, Elijah.
Thank you so much.
I tried letting it die, and I tried to believe you were a liar, but I was measuring the emptiness the whole.
All right, folks, and we are back. Well, we have tons of time left on this week's episode, so let's get to all of the latest LGBTQ news that's out there. Very exciting times here in Cleveland, my friends. This is not necessarily LGBT related, but very exciting times here in Cleveland as we are in the middle of a World Series. The Cavs had their home opener and they got their championship rings. The Indians are playing there at Progressive Field. But as I urge you all the time to please show up for other people, you know, some of the folks that we need to show up for would be our Native American brothers and sisters. The representation of Chief Wahoo that is everywhere, certainly all over Cleveland, but all over the world, as the national sports spotlight is here on Cleveland. This is the most racist depiction that you could ever possibly come up with. And sure, officially, Chief Wahoo is not our mascot. It's our secondary trademark, but that's completely bull because Chief Wahoo is on the sleeve of every Cleveland Indians player. So just putting it out there, our Native American brothers and sisters and all of us with any sensibility should be offended by this depiction. If we even subtly changed the hue of Chief Wahoo's skin, we would immediately say, this is blackface, and we don't condone this. So let's show up for more than just what's going on in the LGBTQ community, because intersectionality, so much power in intersectionality, and we must do something about that. Starting with our LGBTQ stories, I want to talk a bit about Dewey Lanehart and Cody Moore. Dewey Lanehart and Cody Moore. So Dewey and Cody are a couple. They were interviewed by the Wall Street Journal at a Donald J. Trump rally in Cincinnati last week. And the interview with them went instantly viral, and it was about their support for Donald Trump. And one half of the couple said, and I don't know Dewey from Cody, I don't know which is which, I don't know who is who, but one half of the couple deferred to the other half of the couple and said, you tell them why we support Donald Trump. And then the other half of the couple said, well, I work in the steel industry, and Donald Trump is all about reform in trade and reform in business, and I think he'd be good for the economy, and had some solid reasons why they are supporting Donald Trump. And they said they know other gay people who support Donald Trump as well. Well, the video, as I said, went crazy, crazy viral. Unbelievably viral. And as you might expect, the LGBTQ community just savaged these two guys. Just really catty remarks and so dismissive, and people saying that they were traitors and they were morons and they were rednecks, which is another horrible thing to put out there. And what has now been revealed is that Dewey and Cody have said they've even received death threats. Now, do I agree with Dewey and Cody and their support for Donald Trump? Absolutely not. And we'll get to some Donald Trump stories that are coming up in just a few minutes. But the idea that we are going to demonize people who don't agree with us within our own community, I don't like the fact that we demonize anybody. But certainly within the LGBTQ community, there is no monolith on thought. I actually do agree with the idea of, no, the Democratic Party does not own the LGBTQ community. I get why there are people who support the Republican Party. Do I think they're wrong? Yes. Do I think the Democratic Party is the party that is out there fighting for LGBTQ rights? Absolutely. But we don't demonize other folks who don't agree with that. We have conversations with them. We certainly do not put death threats out there. No way. So for all of you out there who posted horrible things, and I really started responding to people on Facebook, really great friends of mine who said, well, these two have a mental illness. Well, first of all, let's stop stigmatizing mental illness and saying that people who don't agree with us have mental illness, because that's not actually a thing, and that doesn't help conversations that we need to be having anyway about mental illness. That said, let's also not diagnose and pathologize and ostracize those in the LGBTQ community who don't agree with us. There is that abstract part where it's kind of awesome that we're at this point right now where we don't all have to say the same thing. And we often did have to say the same thing because we were fighting like hell for our rights, and we still are. I want to be very clear. You can't possibly listen to this part and think, well, Ken's a Republican, or Ken does not support full equality, which we don't currently have. I'm living in a state right now, the state of Ohio, that doesn't have legal protections that other states have. We don't have protections in housing. We don't have protections in employment for the LGBTQ community. We don't have protections in public accommodations. We are not one of the states. We stand with the majority of states where there is not a ban on reparative therapy on minors, the very deadly practice of reparative therapy on minors. We don't have a ban on that. And I learned this week, we're one of only three states where you cannot change the sex on your driver's license. You cannot change the gender on your driver's license to match up with your actual gender. You can't do that. We're hanging out here in Ohio with our brothers and sisters in Kentucky and Tennessee. That's not something to be proud of, with all due respect to my brothers and sisters in Kentucky and Tennessee. So, yes, we are still fighting for equality. Yes, there is still so much work to be done. But what we don't do, what we should not be doing, is savaging and death threats. Are you kidding me? To people who don't agree with us. Sit down and have a conversation with them. We talked about this on last week's show. Peter Thiel wrote his whole op-ed. He gave millions of dollars to Donald Trump. Do I agree with what he did and what he says? Absolutely not. But you have a conversation with him. You don't savage him. You don't say he clearly has a mental health issue. That's not how we have conversations. Somewhere in there, I do think that there's something positive that we don't all have to say the same thing. So that's kind of cool. And again, I don't agree with a lot of these points of view. But yay, diversity of thought. Let's create that. So that is my ode, my ode to Dewey Lanehart and Cody Moore, who, my LGBTQ brother and sister, do not give them death threats. Do not belittle them in that way. Say, you guys are just wrong. You're just wrong in what you're putting out there. It's myopic, the way that you're seeing this election. I'm fine with all that. But death threats and belittling and ostracizing them, give me a freaking break. That's not how we have conversation. On the other side of the spectrum, we have my alma mater. That would be New York University, where I received my bachelor's degree and my master's degree. Well, New York University has cited safety concerns in canceling an upcoming appearance by Milo Yiannopoulos. They claimed his presence, the presence of this alt-right firebrand, they said his presence on campus may trigger violence against members of minority communities, including the LGBT community. Mark Wace, the senior vice president of student affairs, who's been there forever. He was there when I was there, and it was a while ago since I've been there. Mark said this, quote, on other campuses, his events have been accompanied by physical altercations, the need for drastically enlarged security presence, harassment of community members, both at the event and beyond, and credible threats involving the presence of firearms or explosives. Milo had been invited to NYU by the NYU College Republicans. He was to deliver a speech as part of his Dangerous Faggot Tour. That's actually what he calls his tour, everybody. Currently touring American college campuses. According to Milo himself, the speaking tour's intent is to establish resistance to political correctness, the social justice movement, and dispel liberal interests like the wage gap and rape culture as, quote, myths. He's saying that the wage gap and rape culture are myths. NYU is only the most recent campus to ban Milo due to his controversial talking points, which include the belief that feminism is cancer, that being gay is a choice, and that America has a Muslim problem. Before his event at George Washington University in September, a student op-ed referred to Milo as the poster child for alt-right intolerance and condemned his racist, sexist, Islamophobic, and transphobic rhetoric. Mark Ways, again, that vice president at NYU, said that Milo's own words demonstrate, quote, concerns about the safety and well-being of our community. There you go. The NYU venue's proximity to the Islamic Center, the LGBTQ Student Center, and the Center for Multicultural Education and Programs could inspire attacks against students of those groups. The College Republicans called NYU's decision unfair and deeply troubling in a statement to the Washington Square News. Oh, the Washington Square News. This has nothing to do with anything, but I used to have a column in the Washington Square News in 1995 and 1996. I had an op-ed, a whole column. It was called A Day in the Life. It had a little hourglass. It wasn't very good writing, but I miss the Washington Square News. Anyway, the NYU College Republicans said this, quote, you have chosen to willfully ignore that the overwhelming majority of physical altercations and violence at Mr. Yiannopoulos' past events have been directed at him and the audience, not carried out by them. It is deeply offensive to use this pretext to justify using the power of the NYU establishment to allow one group of students to silence another at will. Now, this is an interesting piece of the story. Drew Weber, the vice president of the College Democrats, said NYU should welcome debate across party lines, but insisted that Milo is not the right person to have that debate. Weber said this, quote, it is important we have room for perspectives from both sides of the aisle at NYU. However, Mr. Yiannopoulos' rhetoric extends well past the bounds of constructive dialogue into violence inciting hate speech. It is impossible to have an environment of free speech when student safety is threatened due to their religious, racial, or gender identity, right? So this is a hard one for me. This is a little bit of a hard story because I like the idea of students inviting people on campus who are going to challenge conventional thought, who are going to bring forward a minority opinion. But I have to agree with this student, Drew Weber, and maybe this makes me a hypocrite. I'm open to being called that. Milo Yiannopoulos is not the right person to do that. His rhetoric is violent. It is. He says horrible, horrible, offensive things. And by the way, it is so clear that he says these things to get press attention. It's not out of conviction. Milo is the first to say, I make a ton of money off of saying these things. This used to be not what he put forth to the world. But then he saw, I can make a lot of money off of saying stuff like this. And so now he does. So there's not even the conviction behind it. And so I agree, Milo Yiannopoulos, not the one to have this conversation, but yes, let's encourage conversation where minority opinions are put forward, where contrary opinions are put forward. At one of the schools I worked at, there was a lecture series specifically for highlighting speakers who came to campus who had controversial opinions. But there has to be a line drawn somewhere, and I have to err on the side of, yeah, if I have to pay extra money for security, which you would have to do with Milo Yiannopoulos, this is not helping us at all. This is not helping the free exchange of ideas. Milo is not about the free exchange of ideas. He is about shutting down conversation. He is the first person to say it. So is this censorship? It's kind of what Milo's advocating. Sit down and shut the hell up if you have an opinion that in any way has anything to do with rape culture. He uses the R word that is often used, which I will not say on the show, to describe people with mental disabilities, right? He uses that word. He just used it the other day to describe our transgender brothers and sisters. Why are we inviting him to campus? This in no way furthers the free exchange of ideas. Instead, it shuts it down. So I support my alma mater. Go Violets. Go Bobcats. Go NYU. How about our North Carolina update for the week? We have two North Carolina updates for the week. North Carolina is being dealt a $250,000 blow to its local economy after yet another company has opted not to do business with the ailing state over House Bill 2. Why are these changes not happening yet there in North Carolina? You're losing tons of money. CoStar Group, a Washington, D.C.-based real estate analytics firm, has opted against opening a new operations center in Charlotte, one that would add 730 jobs to the local economy. The move would have reportedly meant a $250 million investment in the city, but CoStar announced plans this week to move to Richmond, Virginia instead. Atlanta and Kansas City, Missouri had also been in the running for the contract. CoStar's commercial real estate broker David Dorsch told the Charlotte Business Journal that the company didn't want to be associated with discrimination. The realtor said this, quote, "The primary reason they chose Richmond over Charlotte was HB2. This is the latest business to pull out of North Carolina in response to the passage of HB2. Really unbelievable. Just losing money. Losing money. By the way, another kind of bizarre angle to this story. North Carolina has demanded, they have now demanded that PayPal give back a ceremonial wooden bowl after the company canceled an expansion over the state's anti-LGBT law, HB2. They have lost a string of big investments over Governor Pat McCrory's decision to sign HB2, which voided, not that I need to remind you, but let's just say it again, HB2 voided all local ordinances protecting LGBT rights, banned transgender people from using their preferred bathroom, and it permits businesses to discriminate against LGBT people on the ground of religious belief. Well, PayPal was one of the first companies to boycott HB2. The online payments company canceled a planned headquarters in April that would have brought 400 jobs to North Carolina. Before the cancellation, this is kind of hilarious, the planned PayPal hub had been relentlessly spun by McRory, Governor McRory, as an economic victory. Okay? Now, this is the hilarious part, not that it was an economic victory. Relations between the state and the payments company have now become so bad that officials in North Carolina have demanded that PayPal return a ceremonial wooden bowl that the company had been presented with earlier this year. The special bowl is apparently made from the wood of a tree near the state capitol. 340 of these bowls were made and given to companies that invested in the state. And now, the North Carolina Commerce Secretary, John Scavarla, he said, "We want the bowl back." He said this, quote, "We reached out to them and said, give us the bowl back. That is a North Carolina artifact from the North Carolina State Capitol made by North Carolina artisans for companies that are coming into North Carolina." He has confirmed that PayPal has returned the wooden bowl. They asked for a ceremonial wooden bowl back. They are not willing to address HB2, but they damn well want their ceremonial wooden bowl back. And they're losing hundreds of millions of dollars. It's unbelievable. $250 million just with that one company, CoStar Group, leaving. And they persist. I don't get it. All right, let's talk about Donald Trump. The Log Cabin Republicans made news this week. They announced that they will not be endorsing Donald Trump. The Log Cabin Republicans, the LGBT political group, the group acknowledged that Trump's choice of advisors concerned them as they have a record of opposing LGBT equality. The organization praised Trump himself, despite the GOP putting support behind anti-LGBT laws. Trump, just to review, has claimed that he would consider appointing ultra-conservative Supreme Court justices to repeal marriage equality. Donald Trump came out in favor of North Carolina's HB2, and Donald Trump's running mate, Mike Pence, has confirmed he would dismantle Barack Obama's protections for LGBT people. This is what the Log Cabin Republican said, quote, "Mr. Trump is perhaps the most pro-LGBT presidential nominee in the history of the Republican Party. His unprecedented overtures to the LGBTQ community, a first for any major party candidate in our nation's history, are worthy of praise and should serve as a clarion call to the GOP that the days of needing to toe an anti-LGBT line are now a thing of the past. As Mr. Trump spoke positively about the LGBT community in the United States, he concurrently surrounded himself with senior advisors with a record of opposing LGBT equality and committed himself to supporting legislation such as the so-called First Amendment Defense Act. And this is an act that the Log Cabin Republicans oppose." So that is what they are saying. Donald Trump is great, except for the part that he supports the First Amendment Defense Act, which, you know, really does strip us of our rights, and he's surrounding himself with people who would strip the LGBTQ community of our rights. So again, have a conversation with our LGBTQ Republican brothers and sisters. Don't send them death threats. Don't do that. But let's be clear, this is not a good situation in the Republican Party. Is it maybe better than it was? Sure, we'll go with the fact that it's maybe better than it was for Republicans, but it's still not great. Mike Pence, vice presidential candidate, very much supports conversion therapy. He makes no bones about it. By the way, another fun Donald Trump story. While Donald Trump's slogan, "Make America Great Again," means different things to different people, to some it means reversing LGBTQ people's progress towards equality. Among them, a woman interviewed by CBS News after last week's presidential debate. Barbara, her name is Barbara, one of a group of Nevada voters interviewed by CBS's John Dickerson after the debate. Barbara said she considers morality and values the most important issues in politics, and she said she would like to see the U.S. go back to what the country was based on. She said this, quote, "I think that the laws that Obama has passed, the way the country has, I call it, downturning, some of the other people are proud of it and happy for it. I personally am against it. The homosexuals, the abortions, all this stuff, I am against." She got some airtime right there on CBS right after the debate. So there was that. Another story of people saying some pretty nutty things. A pastor has prophesied that pedophilia will soon be renamed happy and legalized. Rick Scarborough of Vision America made the claim while preaching at Trinity Family Church in Forney, Texas. In the sermon, Scarborough picked apart the use of the term gay, which originally meant joyful and carefree, insisting on referring to same-sex couples as sodomites because apparently we still use the word sodomites. According to Right Wing Watch, he fumed, quote, "What's next, pedophilia? When we called homosexuality instead of sodomy gay, it changed everything because everyone wants to be gay. So let's just change pedophilia to happy, and we'll have all kinds of leagues of happy people, and we'll have the lobby for happy people. Who wants to keep somebody from being happy? I don't know how long we've got, but I intend to fight this." By the way, Pastor, I stand with you in fighting pedophilia, but I don't think it's going to be renamed happy. I don't really see that coming. Why do we cover stories like this? Because this guy has an audience. He has an audience. We need to know that things like this are said. On the other side of the spectrum, I love that Michael Moore, filmmaker Michael Moore. Michael Moore, he has been out there in the news. He's got a new film out there about Donald Trump, except it's not really about Donald Trump. He was on The View. I watched this clip on The View. He said it's actually really about Hillary Clinton. But his new film is called Michael Moore in Trump Land. And he was on The View, and Candace Cameron, she lamented, quote, "I wish Hillary Clinton played up her Christian, I don't want to say the Christian card, but I wish she played up her faith and talked about it more. I understand why she doesn't, but I'd like to hear about it more." And she added this, "With some of her positions, I don't believe she lives it. I understand she's giving everybody a choice, but for those people that really look to the Bible, it understanding her positions is very difficult." Well, this is how Michael Moore responded, and I encourage you to watch the clip. He said this, quote, "What I would say to the people who are against abortion is, if you are against it, don't have one. If you are against gay marriage, don't get gay married. You won't like it. It's not for you. But live and let live. You live your faith in the way you believe you should live it, and let other people do their thing. The majority in this country are pro-choice. They believe women should be paid the same as men. They believe we should have clean air and drink clean water. We agree on so many things, and the few things we disagree on, let's just agree to disagree." It's a great segment on The View. Great, great segment on The View, and I encourage you to check it out because some wonderful stuff. Great exchange. Really respectful. We're role modeling what respectful discourse looks like. And Michael Moore and Candace Cameron, that's what it looks like. One more story for you. Sean Hayes. It's a very interesting story. Will and Grace star Sean Hayes was honored as an LGBT trailblazer this weekend, but he admitted he still regrets not coming out while the show was still on the air. He was presented with an award at the Outfest Legacy Awards last weekend, and he received a standing ovation for his emotional acceptance speech, during which he said that he is consumed by what he didn't do. He said this, quote, "I was a young closeted actor having his first taste of a little success, and unfortunately, in my mind, my lucky break was inextricably tied to me thinking that I had to stay in the closet in order to keep moving forward. When it comes to nights like tonight and honors like this, I'm consumed with what I didn't do." He went on to say, quote, "I know I should have come out sooner, and I'm sorry for that, especially when I think about the possibility that I might have made a difference in someone's life. I would probably be able to sleep a lot better than I do if I'd acted sooner, but such is life. We learn our lessons only when we are ready." Right, folks? Isn't that true? We learn our lessons only when we are ready. So I applaud you, Sean Hayes, both for this statement and everything that you've done. And I applaud you guys. You guys are out there using your voice. You know what to do. You know that you have to make a difference because that's why we have voices. You just got to figure out your way of doing it. Whether you are playing the violin like our beloved Elijah Oberman from the Shondas, please go download their album. Whether you have your own radio show, whether you have a book coming out, and we have exciting news about that next week, do what it is that you do to use your voice to make a difference for your LGBTQ brothers and sisters, for all our allies out there. Get out there, make a difference. And while you're out there using your voice, while you're out there making a difference, please remember, why be gay when you can be so gay?